Accession number 16251, Real One.
Major Winter, Real One. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Chaubatia in India.
Chaubatia?
Chaubatia, Chaubattia.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a company sergeant major in the 1st Battalion of the Leinster Regiment, an Irish regiment.
Did you go to school in Britain?
I came home, actually, during the war with my mother, whilst my father, being a mad Irishman, was with the battalion when they moved over to Gallipoli, and also he went to the war in Germany, you know, France and Germany afterwards. My mother died, unfortunately, about 1922, and I was brought up by my grandmother, who was on her own, and my sister, and I was educated at a Catholic school in Plymouth. But the tragic part about this was that the Catholic schools in those days were more concerned with pushing religion into the students, and I was learning nothing virtually. My grandmother saw it, and she arranged for my father to fund the schooling at a grammar school, which was the Hoe Grammar School in Plymouth. And I went to the school after failing an entry test because I knew so little. And I was virtually two places below what I should have been in the school classes. But the teachers there were excellent, and I eventually caught up with the rest. And eventually I became the vice captain of the school before I took up my apprenticeship with the a fellow called Reed, who was a pharmacist in Albert Road in Devonport.
How did you come to be in the army, and when?
I was apprenticed to a chemist for 3.5 years, and having completed my apprenticeship, I then had to go on and qualify at a technical college. The chemist I was working or had served with was not prepared to pay me for working with him, because in those days, to become an apprentice, one had to pay to become an apprentice, and once the money was used up, you were on your own. So I had to leave, and I went and got a job with a chemist in Devonport called Reed. And he was a bit of a taskmaster in many ways, because he'd been a very successful chemist in his day and manufactured a lot of his own goods and stuff like that, which he sold to, you know, other chemists' shops and so forth, his preparations. And I used to have to do this. I used to have to do serving in the shop, and I used to have to do the window dressing, everything of that nature, without any assistance whatsoever, whilst he sat in his little cubbyhole in the back, drinking a bottle of scotch a day. This was the situation as it was then, as you can imagine. So I was a bit unhappy about this, and I decided there must be better ways. He was paying me £2 a week, that's all. And I decided that perhaps the army might have something to offer. So I went to the local recruiting office, and I saw the recruiting sergeant. And he said to me, "I wouldn't join the RAMC if I were you." He said, "It's quite a stiff examination to get into the RAMC. why don't you join the Devonshire Regiment? And I said I didn't want to join the Devonshire Regiment because I had no interest in being an infantryman. I wanted to follow my trade. And he said, what trade is that? And I said, I was a pharmacist, a trainee. Oh, he said, you can do that when you're in the RAMC. And eventually he agreed that I could take the exam, which only took me 5 minutes to finish, although they allowed 2 hours. So I think all they were after, really, was whether I could read and write, as it was in those days, you know, back in the 30s. Anyhow, I found out afterwards that the reason he was so pushy about me joining the Devonshire Regiment was he got a 5 shillings joining fee for the Devonshires, but only 4 bob for the RAMC. So that was one of these peculiar situations. Anyhow, I got to the depot at Higlines at Crookham, and my first interview with the company commander, he asked me what I wanted to be, and I told him a dispenser, at which I got a big horse laugh, because as he explained to me, to be a dispenser in the RAMC, you had to serve at least 3 years as a soldier. Then you might get qualifications which would enable you to become a lance corporal. And then, following 2 years, you could get possibly corporal, at which case then you were sent to the School of Dispensing at Keele Barracks here. It was then, no, at Puckridge Camp, though, and, before it moved over here, but Puckridge Camp was where... do you know it at all?
This is Aldershot we're talking
Aldershot, about. Yes. Anyhow, I had joined, and I had to put up with it. So I decided to make the best of it, and I joined in all the activities of a recruit. It was hard going. Up early in the morning and shaving in cold water in an outside wash basin place. March to have a shower once a week. And lots of sport. And I was very active in sport because I played a lot of sport at school, at the Hoe Grammar School, where I actually became captain of the team. And I also played at the technical college, which I went to while I was serving with Reed. I used to get a half a day a week on a Wednesday afternoon to go to the technical college. But it was, I'm rambling around here a bit, but it's, as these reminiscences come back to me, they wanted me to stay on the depot staff because I was a good footballer and they always had a good staff team. So I was given a job on the depot staff as what they called in those days a hut orderly. And a hut orderly was a chap who looked after a hut and was responsible for cleaning the bed spaces of every recruit within that hut. The reason being that recruits were so pushed to get their jobs done that they didn't have time to clean their bed spaces. So for this service, I used to be able to charge 6 pence a week for each recruit. As a result, I was able to double my pay, which at that time was 2 shillings a day. Very interesting period of time. And additionally, I was also given the job of the recreation room orderly. And I'd almost forgotten this part, but it had a billiard table in there and I had a billiard iron on a pot-bellied stove. I don't know whether you remember those old...
Yes.
Well, I used to heat this iron up and I decided that I might as well use the iron for other purposes. And that was to press clothes, as a result of which I was, the company sergeant major used to come in and get me, I used to do it free for him because he was the company sergeant major. but anybody else used to charge them sixpence for pressing their uniforms, so they would be turned out nice and smart. But that lasted, I suppose I was there about a year, and I was posted down to the military hospital at Netley. And I took my nursing qualification down there for class 3 nurse, which was not a very difficult thing. And I served there mostly, though, once they found I got dispensing experience, in the transport medical stores. And this is where I was able to bring my dispensing knowledge out, because in those days troop ships used to come in to Southampton, and I had to go down and offload all the dispensary equipment from the troop ship and bring it all back to the hospital and replace it with a complete outfit, so that they were able to have a quick turnaround. Then when I was able to check through the dispensary stuff, checked against their invoices and what they dispensed and so forth, and make it up to scratch again, ready for a further turnaround when the next troop ship came in. So it was quite interesting at that time. The sergeant in charge of the dispensary was a peculiar bloke, actually. My first meeting with him, first words when I went in there, and he said, "Oh, you're Private Winter." I said, "Yeah." "Do you dance?" he said. So I thought this was a curious thing for him to say. And I said, "Well, I know how to dance. Why?" He said, "Well, I've been," he said, "I joined a dance club in Southampton," he said, "and I'm getting a new routine ready, and I want to practice it." He said, "If you can dance, you can be my female partner." Well, I practiced this one, and this is my first introduction to the medical stores. Anyhow, he was all right. He was a bad chap at the end. But they found out that I wanted to go overseas, and they posted me to Malta. And this was 1939. And when I got to Malta, I again was at the military hospital at Imtiaza. And it was here that I... it was difficult to say. I was engaged a lot in tennis and sports, and I ran all the sports teams and everything else like that. And I qualified eventually as a nursing orderly, class 1. And I was only one mark out in getting the Leishman Prize for the best paper submitted in the Corps during the examination period. But early 1940, I felt that I was really wasting my time, and I got my nursing qualification. I couldn't get any further, and I suppose, being a very active chap, I decided that the war was not going anywhere for me, because Malta wasn't being bombed or anything like that in those days. And I managed to get posted back to England, and there was no problem on that. And when I got back to the depot in England, I went on a few days' leave. And then on reporting back, I was posted to number 1 independent company. And I didn't know what number 1 independent company was, neither did anybody else. And when I got there, all I got, it was in Martock in Somerset. There was just a field and a huge amount of stores around. And there was a sergeant and about a half a dozen other soldiers. And I went down there with another 7 hour EMC. And we were told to get our shirts off and get cracking. And what we had to do is to put tents up. And these tents were apparently to receive the rest of the number one independent company. So we managed to do that all right. And then about 3 days later, convoys of lorries came from the railway station and offloaded the scruffiest load of soldiers I've ever seen in my life. They were all Highland Light Infantry, and I'd never liked the Scots very much, but when I was suddenly faced with 500 of them, it was a bit traumatic, I'm afraid.
They were to join the Independent
Company. And they were the members of the Independent Company. Anyhow, a doctor eventually arrived. So there was a Captain McLean was the doctor, myself as a full corporal, and seven privates, all nurses. And we were then told that we would be informed of our role and what we were going to do. So the next day, the commanding officer arrived and opened up his envelope and said, "Well, now, chaps, so nice to see all you volunteers here today." And that, of course, was the first time I knew I was a volunteer. And the other fellows as well. And then suddenly in through the gateway drove another lorry, and another eight REMC arrived, all Territorial Army. I was in charge of regular army troops. So the CO looked at his sort of brief and he found he was only entitled to eight REMC, so the others were sent packing again. Somebody had duplicated something somewhere. And he decided a regular, one regular is probably better than 10 TA. I'm not sure what his feelings were on the matter. Anyhow, we were told that we were to go to Scotland. And these fellows had only just come down from Scotland. And 48 hours later, we were on a train up to Gourock. And we found ourselves on board an old cattle boat. This was accommodation was based on eight soldiers to one stall. And, of course, it hadn't been very well cleaned out. As you can imagine, they transported cattle, which I don't know where they put their cattle to. You know. But anyhow, we were there and we had to make the best of it. And we were also then brought up on top deck in the night time because she sailed without lights. And they did everything, they battened down below decks during the daytime.
Did you know where you were going?
We didn't know we were going nowhere, no idea. That wasn't disclosed to us at all. And issue of weapons that came up, and they had to make up their minds whether the REMC were going to be issued weapons or not. And I had to make it quite clear that according to the Geneva Convention, REMC were entitled to carry weapons, not for assault purposes, but in defense of their patients and themselves, of course. So we were not to be utilized in an assault in any way. The issue was a new type of Swedish machine gun, rather similar in many ways to the old Sten gun. It was called a Sumi gun, and it had a maximum distance, I suppose, of about 200 yards. It wasn't very good, and it had lots of defects, but the only way we got any practice in using it was firing off bullets into the sea and trying to hit tin cans and stuff like that. Not very satisfactory form of training for a new weapon. And we eventually arrived and we suddenly spotted through the sort of portholes there, we were going up fjord. And then the rumour went around, of course, that we obviously were in Norway. And when we got to Norway, we offloaded and we found that we're in a little place called Mo i Rana. And the entire population of this little village came down and helped us offload our stores. And I personally needed a lot of assistance in offloading my stores, because although there were only 8 REMC, we had been issued with the entire medical stores of a field ambulance. Now, those are normally carried on three-ton lorries, panniers, all that sort of thing. So the doc and I got our heads together, because he was a TA doctor, didn't know much about the REMC at all. And he decided that we better break down in man-packed loads, so that we had Bergen rucksacks issued to us, and we sorted out, and he sorted out what he wanted of them in medical equipment and surgical instruments, all that sort of thing. And we were each then allotted a certain amount of medical equipment to carry, and the rest of it just left. Presumably the inhabitants of Mo i Rana got the rest of it. After 24 hours, I suppose, we found there was another ship coming in, and it had a battalion, I think it was the Irish Guards, over there. I'm absolutely certain it was the Irish Guards that came over there. But I never saw them, because we were told to do our bit at that stage and go in, hit the enemy where it hurts most, and don't get caught, and scarper back again out of the way. In other words, do as much damage as you can, which, of course, is the province of the commandos nowadays, really. And we did get in. We did no damage, and we scarpered.
Get in where?
To the Germans. In other words, we would see Germans in the distance. The HLI would go forward while we stayed with the back a bit in what you might call the headquarters area. And the battalion stretcher bearers should have brought casualties back to us. But they didn't do this at that stage. And they went in, they lost a few soldiers, and then came back and joined the rest of us. It was, they had nothing to work with. I mean, all they got was a few hand grenades and these Swedish sort of submachine gun type of thing.
In what kind of country was this?
Oh, up in the mountains, of the fjords. The time of the year was April, so it was fairly light right up to quite late at night, because, as you know, the further north you get, the lighter it gets. And we had no transport. We had no means of evacuating our casualties. We were informed that the nearest field medical unit was, in fact, a place called Bodø, which must have been about 200 miles north of us. So the only way we could evacuate our casualties when we got them was by commandeering two private cars, the biggest we could find, and we took it in turns, the doctor and myself, to drive our casualties by car all the way up to the field ambulance and then come back again. And we did this on a rota basis, because there were only two REMC chaps could drive. We had no service corps with us at all. So there were no drivers, in other words. This is how badly organized the whole thing was, really.
Anyhow, were you handling many casualties?
Not a great number, no. Because the infantry didn't really get in far enough, you know, to the enemy to suffer many casualties. As soon as they came under fire with superior weaponry, they scarpered. And you can't blame them for that either. So every day, of course, the distance between ourselves and the field ambulance narrowed because we were making fairly rapid progress. We had to learn, as best we could, how to ski, because if we went off the roads, there was still a lot of snow around. And this was the first time that I personally had ever tried skiing, and I found it hard going, but naturally, because it wasn't so much on the going lovely down slopes and with, as you see it on the TV, you were sort of slogging away one foot in front of the other, trying to make movement. But we managed in the end, and we got to Bodo. Let me think, it was late May, I think it was, where we were pushed that far back by the Germans, and we looked as if we were going to be caught. And we were on the dockside there, and suddenly out of the, around the corner of a fjord, we saw a destroyer come in. And it lined up by the side of the jetty, and the sailors were shouting at us, "Get the hell a move on, jump for it, come on, move. We're not stopping. Anybody who doesn't get aboard is left." And the order came, "Dump your equipment." So we dropped everything, including our weapons and rucksacks, the works. The only thing that we salvaged from that was the dock wanted the surgical instruments that were there in a sort of, and he jumped with that in his hands. And everything else we lost. And within 15 minutes, I suppose everybody was aboard, and the destroyer suddenly got a move on and pulled out of the fjord, and we weren't bombed. We thought we were going to be bombed because there had been bombings of these quayside evacuation places.
Did you know the name of the destroyer?
I don't know the name of that one, but I know that we went to the Arethusa, which was in mid-North Sea, and we were transferred to the Arethusa. And that was the first time we had a really satisfying meal. Fresh bread, you know, soup, the works. We were in a sorry state, I must say. And they took us to the Orkney Islands. And we were landed at Stromness, and put in a hutted camp there. A tented camp, not a hutted one. A tented camp. And we were incommunicado for a while. And we didn't know what was going on in the world at all, what was happening. We only knew that we felt very badly let down ourselves, because we just didn't have any backup support of any kind whatsoever. From what I can gather, there were 10 of these independent companies formed, but only 5 of them actually got to Norway. But where the others were, I have not a clue. I only know where I was. When we got to Stromness, we were eventually informed that the evacuation of Dunkirk had taken place. So you can see the times...